Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The mental health professionals were slow to arrive and quick to leave. The police were quick to come. And a mentally ill 18-year-old was dead in 14 minutes. Let's take a closer look at the death of Kyle Coppin on Gates Avenue in Bed-Stuy on Monday night. Could it have been prevented? With so much of our prison population also mentally ill, so many Iraq War veterans, too. This is a story with big implications for many Americans. The thin line between freedom and incarceration, even between life and death itself. We have two guests, Daily News columnist Ara Lewis, who got an exclusive interview with Kyle Coppin's mother yesterday, and John Jay College of Criminal Justice professor Eugene O'Donnell. He's a professor of law and police science, a former police officer, former prosecutor. Welcome back, both of you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And Errol, maybe the first thing to know about this tragedy is that his mother called a mental health team hours before she called the police. They came reportedly hours later and did not wait even a few minutes for Kyle, who was not there, to return home. And less than an hour later, he was dead. Did the Interfaith Medical Center team fail Kyle Coppin?
Well, that's one of the big questions that's going to get answered here. A lot of the focus so far has been on law enforcement. And, of course, we'll end up talking, I'm sure, this morning about whether they're the best first responders in these cases. But the mom who I spent some time with yesterday, she did what I think anyone would have done, which is she reached out for counselors, for medical assistance for her disturbed son. And she was not at all happy with the response. That, as you mentioned, they came late. They stayed a very short time. She said the fellow that she was trying to deal with gave her a card and was very dismissive and said he had to keep going.
Yeah. Eugene O'Donnell, what's the interface between those kinds of services and law enforcement? I mean, I'm sure they're overworked like other emergency services. But what's the responsibility of a hospital mental health team to stay if the patient is not home or to move on to other emergency calls? I think the police would have an obligation to stay.
Hello, Brian?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can now, yes.
Okay. So I was asking
Sure. If
you're familiar with the mental health teams, and I realize you teach police science, but they work with each other, or maybe they don't work with each other enough.
Well,
but
you
it's not a
good time for finger pointing, especially in light of the fact that this was an accident, a problem, an issue waiting to happen. It's something that's going to happen again because there's lots of organizations that should be handling these issues, the school system, mental health, health and hospitals. There's a broad range of people, non-government agencies, law enforcement as an absolute last resort. And we have this fractured sort of dysfunctional system. And I think it's important to note, I think Errol's column pointed it out this morning, you know, the families and the loved ones of these people are often overwhelmed themselves. They don't know where to turn. And it's incumbent on us now to build a system, fix a system, and have something in place so that people that are trying to do the best thing for their families, their loved ones, have a place to turn and have an immediate, reliable, quick response, and that we don't make emergencies. We're making emergencies. We're creating emergencies because we're failing to assess these things quickly, and we're creating the police as a stopgap, to the absolute worst stopgap. And of course, not only incidentally, you know, does the family become victimized, and this 18-year-old man now is dead, but the police officers are victims of this failure to act with urgency.
So, on the question that most people are asking, let me get both of you on this. Were the police officers justified in shooting? There are so many facts here that people are piecing together. The 911 call in which Kyle says he has a gun, but a second one in which his mother says he does not. He was brandishing knives when the police arrived. He did have what might have been a suicide note on him. He did continue to claim he had a gun. The police called for specialists in nonviolent crisis intervention, but Kyle slipped out the back and confronted other officers who may not have been fully informed about the situation. Kyle ignored orders to halt and put up his hands. He was reaching for something under his shirt, which turned out to be a hairbrush. Errol, can you blame the police? Is this another Sean Bell or Amadou Diallo case, or is it quite different?
Well, let me start by taking a little bit of issue with the terminology. When the phrase that comes up is, was it a good shoot? You know, was it justified? And I think, especially in this case where a life is lost, it's entirely inappropriate. It's a, I understand from the police department's point of view, the city's point of view, there's a legal question. You know, are we going to get sued for this? Well, we have to pay out a lot of money in damages. To me, that is almost the least important question. The point for me is not whether or not it was quote unquote justified or legally protected, the actions that were taken. I think the real question is, is this the best way to handle this? I mean, in a with a police force of 30,000 people, and they have guns, and they have gas, and they have helicopters, and they have time. You know, they waited 20 minutes while he was raging around in his room, according to some accounts. If you can wait 20 minutes, why can't you wait 120 minutes?
But the police say that they were waiting it out. They had called specialists in nonviolent intervention in crises like this, but that Kyle slipped out a back window and wound up lunging at officers who did not know all of what was going on. Is that accurate as far as you know?
Yes, as far as I know, that is. The officers not knowing what's going on, that gets to be a problem. You know, why would anyone be at the scene if they didn't understand what was going on, or at least the commanders there? You know, when you take a jaundiced view of it, and I'm sure we're going to hear this because we always hear this when this happens, you know, five or six times a year, the question will come up, wouldn't a rabid dog have been treated with a little bit more care? You know, would, and you know, if you think about it as a thought experiment, if there was a dog that was running around biting people, would cops have encircled that animal and fired on it 20 times?
Eugene O'Donnell, do you want to take a stab at answering that question?
I totally concur with Errol's point. There's a loss of life. It shouldn't have happened. But I don't think we should be engaging in a pick-a-team dialogue, the cops versus the community. That's not the dialogue we should be. There's a failure here, and whatever the cops did or didn't do, it's not a police issue. It was put off on the cops. Best as I can tell, they did the best they could. They, you know, they do follow a protocol that really does have human life at the top of the equation, and they do try to contain these people, and probably there would have been a better chance had this young man stayed in the apartment. But once he left, it created a complicated situation. And the catch-22 in policing is the officers who are probably less or trained to deal with these issues are the first people to get to the scene. The officers with the highest level of skill are the emergency service cops, and very often these things are more or less over by the time they get there. So in terms of the blue ribbon panel that I've been trying to, you know, push, and hopefully the mayor will consider, everything should be on the table, and one of the things should be on the table is, you know, where police are necessary, how do we get the most skilled, best police people, the mental health people, reliably there, quickly there, you know, and have the highest skill set we can have on the scene when these things become as they do, they got out of control. But it really is important to say, if you look at NYPD procedures, I read them again this morning, they say every step of the way, and I do think they believe this in a heartfelt way, that the preservation of human life is paramount.
Let me also bring in Dr. Pamela Straker. She's quoted in Errol's column today. She is CEO of Brooklyn Care Works, a network of community-based psychiatric centers. Dr. Straker, thank you for coming on WNYC with us. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
So let me ask you first about procedure as you understand it, because ultimately when the police arrived on the scene, mental health professionals were no longer on the scene. They came. The mother was in a crisis state with her son. He had left the apartment, and I guess they didn't know exactly how long he would be out, but she implored them to stay, as I've read the reporting, and they left in only a very few minutes, and then he returned, and within an hour, he was dead. Are there standard procedures that they're supposed to follow in a situation like that?
Well, I'd like not to comment on the procedures in terms of the whether or not the mental health professionals stayed long enough, et cetera. What I would like to comment on is, as the gentleman said previously, we need to move away from blame and really see this as a community issue, meaning the police department is part of the community, the family is part of the community, we are part of the community. And I think there needs to be much more emphasis on educating people as to how to manage someone with mental health issues. You know, mental health issues have have a full range. So you can go from the very mild, where a person is just like all of us walking around and having no danger to self or others. And you can also go all the way to the extreme, where in this case, the person really represented at minimum a danger to himself because of the way he was presenting his behavior. I believe that we need to return to educating the community, getting the police more involved in understanding or in helping police to really manage mental health issues in a different way. I'm not certain about what happened to the procedure that had been developed in terms of stunning a person like this, using a stun gun, et cetera, versus shooting to kill.
Let me ask Professor O'Donnell that. What about a taser? A few people have asked me that question in the last few days. You know, there was that controversial taser incident when somebody was protesting at a John Kerry appearance in Florida recently, and that video went around YouTube so much, a lot of Americans who had never before seen a taser in action got to see one. But one thing that we saw was that it completely disables the person, but for a short amount of time, long enough to restrain them, mostly no damage, no permanent damage is done. Why wouldn't they consider a taser in a situation like this?
Well, we don't know that they didn't. I think the difficulty is these things turn literally on they're moment-to-moment events, and information, cops have to weigh and evaluate the information as they're getting it. Almost always, it's a fractured kind of piece of information, and sometimes there's even, I wouldn't necessarily say a malicious introduction of a non-issue, but somebody introduced the issue of a gun here on the 911 tape, and that, I would assume, changed the character of the police response.
You know what? I want to actually play the 911 tape. The transcript of this is appearing in the papers today, and we can play the audio. It's a little bit difficult to hear, but listen closely. You will hear primarily Kyle Coppin's mother speaking to a 911 dispatcher. You'll hear the voice of the dispatcher, and in the background, Kyle himself, who is the one who says he has a gun.
Between Marcus Garvey and Trump, what happened there?
I'm just kidding, because he can't hear his behavior.
Who is that?
That's supposed to be my son.
That's your son?
Yeah, got no respect. And you know what, I can't see with this tonight.
He say he has a gun?
Uh-huh. And maybe you heard him. I didn't say it. You heard it out of his mouth.
He didn't injure you, right?
No, but if you keep on tonight with this situation here, I'm not sleeping in here with this behavior.
Okay.
So, again, I'm sure that was very hard to hear for many of you because the audio was so bad. But
if I could comment on that.
Dr. Straker, please.
It's very difficult to make an analysis of this situation based solely on the 911 tape. There were things that went on before that we all know. And my question would be whether in that 911 transaction, whether it was ever communicated clearly that this person had a mental health history. And I didn't get that from the tape. You know, from what I've heard from the tape, so that, you know, we don't know what was told to the police in terms of the dispatch. But if we get back to the premise that, you know, we had years ago Eleanor Bumpers, we've had many people who have presented in a bizarre fashion, who have needed to be taken down, so to speak. I think we have to return to the point where we understand that people with these kinds of illnesses will say things that are provocative, will say things that will cause one to be fearful. And I am concerned not only about the family, but I'm concerned about the police officers who wind up being in these situations where they have shot someone and then later find out that the person does not have a weapon. I mean, I think the mental health issues are broad enough to include the police officers who are now traumatized having shot someone who really did not need to be shot.
Fair enough. And Era Lewis from the Daily News, one of my questions here from reading all the reporting on this is, during their 14 minutes on the scene before he was shot, did the police ever become fully aware of Kyle's psych history? I would imagine it would have been available in a standard instant background check, given that he had some criminal history and some psych history that overlapped. Do you know if they conducted such a check? I think there was some statement to the effect that they didn't have time.
I don't know. This, by the way, took place right near the 79th precinct, where at least some of the responding officers came from. And in fact, the executive officer of the 79th precinct was there. So at least at the level of understanding it to be sufficiently sensitive that a high-ranking officer would come out. I mean, the executive officer is basically the second in command at the precinct. That at least shows that there was a high level of awareness that this was not going to just be a regular call. I think, though, that once you start to parse it and you start to get into, you know, how police department distributes information to officers as they're rushing to a scene, I think you can reliably expect that there's going to be a fall off of information.
Which again, this underscores why we shouldn't be creating these emergencies. If at all possible, they should be avoided. And if at all possible, the police should be the last resort. And there are privacy issues and there are civil liberties issues in exchanging information and giving information to the police that we have to look at. But we need a real dramatic rethink here. This is, you know, we had one after bumpers. The NYPD has tightened up a lot of their procedures. But now is the time for the mental health community and other stakeholders here to step forward and say, this has to come off the police. New York City should be a model on this. We should not be doing this 1950 style, wait till something blows up and call the cops. You know, it's almost akin to calling the fire department out for a robbery. I think if we did that, the firefighters would show up. They would do the best they could. They'd probably get hurt. I think society eventually would be outraged that it was so foolish. And I would argue this is akin to that. The same outrage should follow the idea of sending armed police officers to a mental health psychiatric emergency. It's a little bizarre. It's a little outdated, and it should be avoided.
Eugene O'Donnell from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, former prosecutor, former police officer, Daily News columnist Errol Lewis, still with us. He got an exclusive interview with Kyle Coppin's mother in this morning's paper. And Dr. Pamela Straker, president and CEO of Brooklyn Care Works, a network of psychiatric care centers. And a lot of people are calling in on this, and I want to take some phone calls in the time that we have. And coming up in about 10 minutes, we will talk about the other breaking news story in New York this morning. Governor Spitzer, within the hour, officially walking away from his driver's license for illegal immigrants plan. Joanna in Huntington, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Hi. So I'm a mental health professional. I've been in this situation more than once where I'm the person calling 911. And the variety of responses you get from the police really, it depends on who you get. You get some cops that are great and some cops that are, you know, very responsive. I think that I agree to a large extent with the professor from John Jay's analysis that it's not necessarily the police that should be handling these situations, but the problem is really much broader than what happens in a mental health emergency. The problem is that the entire mental health system is so fragmented. When somebody has a physical illness, we know exactly what's going to happen, right? You have a heart attack at home, you call an ambulance, you get an EMT, you go to the hospital, you get treatment, you get care, et cetera. When somebody is mentally ill, there's really no coherent system, and this is just a symptom of that. So that, you know, somebody's having a mental health crisis, whether it's life-threatening or not, or whether it's dangerous, what do you do? I mean, they're really, it's very, very hard.
Dr. Straker, what do you do?
Well, I agree with her 100%. I think that, again, this is a bit of information that we're not clear about, whether or not the mom could have gotten this person to a hospital and why that part of the system fell apart. But even those of us delivering service in the community find that the system is fragmented, that there is not a consistent way in which our psychiatrists can be assured that if they send someone to an emergency room, they will indeed be admitted. And that is not to blame the hospitals either. There are pressures to bear that have to do with fiscal concerns, that have to do with managed care concerns that prevent people from getting appropriate levels of care. I agree with the statement that we need to have a broad-based approach to this. I believe that there needs to be in this city the determination that this is important enough to make us a model, as was said previously, and that this situation should be used as a way of healing rather than further fragmentation. There will be outrage, and we should be outraged outraged when people are killed, and it feels and looks and is so uncomfortable.
Let me get another caller. Corinne in Bed-Stuy, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is, and I haven't heard anybody ask it, why it is standard procedure, if it is, for the officers to be shooting to kill? Why can't professional police officers shoot to wound, or to fire for professionals shooting at a single person when they don't know the threat?
Professor O'Donnell, I would say a third of our callers right now are calling to ask that question.
Sure, and it's 2007, and the short answer is we shouldn't have to have that scenario. We should have non-lethal, reliable weapons, and maybe New York City could get together with other cities, put up a big amount of money for, you know, to fast forward some research so we can finally get rid of the idea that you have to kill somebody in this day and age in order to contain them. That said, police officers, like anyone else, faced in a deadly in a situation where their life or the life of somebody else is imminently at risk, they will fire as many rounds as they feel they need to extinguish the threat. And if there was a magic number, it would be terrific. Regrettably, history shows us that in the past, police officers have shot people sometimes 15, 20 times, and those people have still had enough ability to kill the officers. So there is no magic number. And also, of course, officers have, unfortunately, a 20% hit rate, so many of the shots they fire, even at close range, don't hit the target.
Era Lewis, you spoke to the mother, who is so widely cited in this case, for calling 911 and first allowing Kyle to give the impression that he had a gun, even though she later said he didn't. What did she tell you yesterday in your interview?
Well, she was stunned. She still clearly had not fully absorbed the magnitude of this complete disaster that had befallen her family. You know, she said that she was simply trying to get him some counseling. In fact, when I asked her if she had summoned medical help, she said she didn't even regard it as a medical issue, that he needed some counseling, that he needed someone to basically talk him down from the state he had worked himself up into. And I don't know how much of that is.
Did she think she was calling 911 for counseling?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and it didn't occur to me until we were having this discussion this morning. When people call 911, they're not necessarily asking to have a contingent of cops come to their house. They're asking for emergency help, and that could be an ambulance, and that could be the fire department, and that could be the police.
And this is one responsible woman. She previously turned Kyle in for a crime, turned in her own son.
Yeah, she made no bones about that he'd been in trouble with the law. You know, his family was really upstanding family, I got to tell you. I mean, the brother, you know, talked about his problems fitting in and why he, you know, had gotten involved in these street muggings.
And the brother just passed the NYPD exam, you reported.
The brother is not only not anti-cop, but he wants to become a cop. He's passed the exam. He's trying to get his citizenship lined up so that he can join the force. He's a very responsible young man, and they've really all just said consistently that what they want is justice. Now, I can tell you that the strain is wearing on them, because they sat for 4 or 5 hours in a dirty precinct house waiting to be told what would happen next, that they were not allowed to even see his body at Woodhull Hospital, that they had to make the ID, they would just show them the face. The body wasn't released for hours and hours and hours. They were locked out of their own house because now it was a crime scene and the police were going through it. So their patience has been, I think, severely tested, and despite all of that, the story hasn't changed, the mood hasn't changed, and their request has not changed, which is that they want a thorough investigation, they want justice, and they don't want this to ever happen to anyone else.
And that's the point I want to end on. And Gene O'Donnell and Pamela Straker, for both of you, is the line between criminality and mental illness one that our society just does not walk very well? Just on Veterans Day, we heard about all these mentally ill and homeless Iraq war vets. We know a large percentage of the people in our state prison system are mentally ill. I wonder how many potential Kyle Coppins are out there, even in our veteran population.
Well, you see, we know that in our veterans population, we do have people who've been affected by mental illness. But we also know that these are situations that are not adequately provided as beds for education. And I think that the important thing, if we could end on anything, is that we need to teach ourselves, each other, the community more about what this means, what mental illness means, how to better manage it, and that, in fact, it is an illness. I have not looked at this young man's background, but I would hazard a guess that even his criminal involvement involved some level or included some level of his mental illness.
Gene O'Donnell, last word.
We've made the safety net here. The reliable safety net here are the cops. They'll come. They're always going to come. And jails. They're always going to be there. And that's a disgrace.
Mm-hmm.
We should invest, and we should use our common sense. And we should in New York be a model, and people should look to the city and say, when people are mentally ill, we have a humane and decent approach to it, and the cops are the last resort. And this kid was, by the way, caught up in the, you know, in the criminal justice system. It didn't seem to do much for him.
Well, if you three are any indication, and I hope you are, out of this terrible tragedy comes another level of understanding and perhaps some response. Eugene O'Donnell, Pamela Straker, Era Lewis, thank you all very much.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in just a minute, Era Lewis will stay on and put on his political analyst hat and will be joined by Danny Hakim from the New York Times in Albany as Governor Spitzer, within the last hour, has officially ditched his driver's licenses for illegal immigrants plan. We'll look at the implications for the presidential race, among other things. Stay with us.